Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipsack. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to have some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Over the last several months, I have been investigating into the whole issue of what is known as the web of debt. We have been using a book called The Web of Debt by Ellen Brown, who's an attorney, to try to understand what is really perceived as the shocking truth about our money system, and of course, ultimately, how we can break free. In short, our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. The Web of Debt is a book that unravels this deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. It then, in a positive vein, explores workable alternatives, one in particular that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It's a very important and ultimately practical presentation of what money is all about, and of course then how to deal with it for our own financial security, for that of the nation, and ultimately the entire globe. At the onset, I'd like to give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 other books and scores of articles in the area of debt. I highly recommend that you actually read her book, The Web of Debt. You can also go to her website by the same name, and you can review all of the shows that we have produced for debt-related issues at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, and specifically Life and Debt Web. Now, let's do a little bit of a review from the last show. We're looking back at President Roosevelt and other influential federal officials who thought it was the way to reverse the depression by urging the greenback cure for the economy. In a congressional address in 1933, Representative Lewis McFadden quoted a Hearst newspaper article by Robert Hemphill, credit manager of the Atlanta Federal Reserve, in which Hemphill argued, open quote, "We are rapidly approaching a situation where the government must issue additional currency. It will very soon be the only move remaining. It should have been the first step in the recovery program. Immediately upon a revival of the demand that the government increase the supply of currency, we shall again be subjected to a barrage of skillfully designed and cunningly circulated propaganda by means of which a small group of international bankers have been able, for two centuries, to frighten the peoples of the civilized world against issuing their own good money in sufficient quantities to carry on their necessary commerce. By this simple but amazingly successful device, these money changers, parasites in a busy world intent on creating and exchanging wealth, have been able to preserve for their private and exclusive right the monopoly of manufacturing an inferior substitute for money, which they have hypnotized civilized nations into using because of their pressing need to exchange goods and services. We shall never recover on credit. Even if it were obtainable, it is uncertain, unreliable, does not expand in accordance with demand, and contracts unexpectedly and for causes unrelated to the needs of commerce and industry. In our present situation, the issue of additional currency is the only way out. Close quotes. Hemp Hill said the government needed to issue enough new debt-free currency to replace what had been lost. Congressman Wright Patman went further. He urged the government to take over ownership and operation of the banks. In an address to Congress on March 13, 1933, he asked rhetorically, open quote, "Why is it necessary to have government ownership and operation of banks?" Let us go back to the Constitution of the United States and follow it. The Constitution of the United States says that Congress shall coin money and regulate its value. That does not mean that the Congress of the United States, composed of the duly elected representatives of the people, have a right to farm out the great privilege to the banking system until today a few powerful bankers control the issuance and distribution of money, something that the Constitution of the United States says Congress shall do. Close quote. Flanked on the right by the classical laissez-faire economists who said the money supply and the banking scheme should not be tampered with at all, and on the left by the radical reformers who said the power to create money and even the banking system itself should be taken over by the government. Roosevelt took the middle road and opted for the Keynesian deficit spending alternative. He expanded the money supply, but he did it without unseating the private banking cartel. Instead, he sidestepped the cartel by expanding the reach of a public funding agency established under President Herbert Hoover. Hoover had set up the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, the RFC, in 1932 as a federally owned bank that would bail out commercial banks by extending loans to them, but Hoover's ploy failed. The banks did not need more loans. They were already drowning in debt. They needed customers with money to spend and to invest. Roosevelt used Hoover's new government-owned lending facility to extend loans where they were most needed, for housing, agriculture, and industry. Many new federal agencies were set up and funded by the RFC, including the HOLC, Homeowners Loan Corporation, and Fannie Mae, the Federal National Mortgage Association, which was then a government-owned agency. In the 1940s, the RFC went into overdrive funding the infrastructure necessary for the U.S. to participate in World War II, setting the country up with the machinery needed to become the world's industrial leader after the war. Although the RFC was a government-owned bank that sidestepped the privately owned Federal Reserve, it had to borrow money before lending it. The RFC was funded by issuing government bonds and relending the proceeds. Roosevelt did not try to dismantle the private Federal Reserve, but he did take steps to restructure it. In 1934, the old Federal Reserve Board was dissolved and replaced by a 7-member board of governors appointed by the U.S. President for 14-year terms. The board was given greatly increased powers, including the power to appoint the presidents of the 12 Federal Reserve banks. The Open Market Committee was created with one representative from each Federal Reserve Bank. It was empowered to inject new money into the economy by using newly created money to purchase government bonds and to remove money from the economy by selling government bonds. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The money supply was better protected by these measures, but the Fed remained a hierarchical citadel run from the top down. Today, even the commercial banks that own the Federal Reserve banks do not have ordinary voting rights. The system is subject to the control of a small clique of appointed banking representatives who operate behind a curtain of secrecy. The head of the Fed has usually been chosen from the private banking sector and has remained aligned with its interests. The country that holds democracy out as an ideal is in the anomalous position of having an economic system controlled by an autocratic head who is beyond the reach not only of the public, but of the Fed's own shareholders. The current Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, came from academia rather than the banking establishment, but he has been criticized for being out of touch with the real economy. His chief problem, however, seems to be that his banking establishment predecessors have left him with a hot air balloon that is about to go the way of the Hindenburg, which we will discuss more about later. In 1933, Roosevelt took a particularly controversial step when he took the dollar off the gold standard. England's pound sterling had been removed from the gold standard in 1931, prompting foreigners to turn to the United States for gold at a time when Federal Reserve notes were 40% backed by that precious metal. This meant that for every $2 cashed in for gold, another $3 in loans had to be called in by the banks. The run on the nation's gold stores dangerously shrank the money supply by shrinking the dollar's gold backing. If everyone holding dollars had been allowed to trade them in for gold, no reserves would have been left to back the dollar, and the money supply could have collapsed completely. To halt that alarming trend, in 1933, Roosevelt pronounced the country officially bankrupt and declared a national emergency. Then, with the wave of the presidential fiat, he changed the Federal Reserve note from a promise to pay in gold into legal tender itself, backed only by the full faith and credit of the United States. The price of gold was subsequently raised, reducing the value of the dollar so that more goods could be sold abroad. But first, all gold coins, gold bullion, and gold certificates held by the public were ordered turned over to the U.S. Treasury under threat of fines and imprisonment. The point of this exercise was evidently to prevent a windfall to gold owners when the price of gold went up. Private gold owners were paid $20.67 per ounce in paper Federal Reserve money for their confiscated gold. Then the price of gold was raised to $35 per ounce. The result was an immediate 40% devaluation of the paper money the public had just received for their gold. The Federal Reserve also had to turn in its gold, but the Fed was paid in gold certificates. Paper money redeemable in gold. Congressman McFadden was outraged. He argued that private gold stores were not needed to rebuild the national money supply since the gold backing had just been removed from the dollar. The Fed was still obligated to redeem foreign holdings of the Federal Reserve notes in gold, and raising the price of gold reduced those obligations, but that was the Fed's problem, not the public's. He accused the Federal Reserve Board and its foreign manipulators of deliberately draining the gold from the U.S. Treasury. Roosevelt did what the international bankers ordered him to do, McFadden charged in his 1934 address to Congress. He is preparing to cancel the war debts by fraud. McFadden maintained that the Fed was legally obligated to redeem its Federal Reserve notes in gold to the American people, and that it had defaulted on this obligation by irresponsibly letting its gold reserves be siphoned off by foreigners. The Fed was bankrupt because of its own misdealings. He told Congress, open quote, "There was no national emergency here when Franklin D. Roosevelt took office accepting the bankruptcy of the Fed. Undercover, the predatory international bankers have been stealthily transferring the burden of the Fed debts to the people's treasury and to the people themselves. They took the farms and the homes of the United States to pay for their thievery. The United States currency is no longer protected by gold. It is therefore sheer dishonesty to say that the people's gold is needed to protect the currency. I see no reason why the general public should be forced to pay the gambling debts of the international bankers." End quote. Although McFadden accused Roosevelt of bowing to the international bankers, FDR was not actually marching to the drummer of his own moneyed class, much to their chagrin. From his first months in office, he implemented tough legislation against the Wall Street looting and corruption that had brought down the stock market and the economy. He took aim at the trusts and monopolies that had returned in force with the laissez-faire government of the Roaring Twenties. By 1929, about 1,200 mergers had swallowed up more than 6,000 previously independent companies, leaving only 200 corporations in control of over half of all American industry. FDR reversed this trend with new legislation, reviving the policies initiated by his cousin Teddy. He also imposed strict regulations on Wall Street. The Glass-Steagall Act was passed, limiting speculation and preventing banks from gambling with money entrusted to them. Regular commercial banks were separated from investment banks dealing with stocks and bonds in order to prevent bankers from creating stock offerings and then underwriting or selling the offerings by hyping the stock. Banks had to choose to be either commercial banks or investment banks. Commercial banks were prohibited from underwriting most securities, with the exception of government-issued bonds. Speculative abuses were regulated through the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, was formed. Information requirements to potential investors were established. Regulations were promulgated for buying securities on margin or on credit, and for bank lending for the purchase of stocks and bonds, and restrictions were placed on the suspect practice known as the short sale, which I will talk more about later. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I am speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Needless to say, the Wall Street financiers were not pleased. "They are unanimous in their hatred of me," Roosevelt said defiantly, "and I welcome their hatred." A clique of big financiers and industrialists was rumored to be so unhappy with the president that they plotted to assassinate him. Major General Smedley Butler testified before Congress that he had been solicited by Morgan banking interests to lead the plot. He said he was told by a Morgan agent that Wall Street was about to cut off credit to the New Deal and that Roosevelt, open quote, has either got to get more money out of us or he has got to change the method of financing the government, and we are going to see that he does not change that method, close quote. That raises the question, change the method of financing the government to what? Hemp Hill had urged the government to issue its own greenback-style currency, and Patman had proposed nationalizing the banks. Greenback-style funding was actually authorized by the Thomas Amendment, which provided that the president could issue $3 billion in new greenbacks if the Federal Reserve banks failed to fund $3 billion in government bonds. That authority was never exercised, but the threat was there. The plot to assassinate Roosevelt failed, but according to Smedley, it was only because he had refused to lead it. As for Congressman McFadden's impeachment action against the Fed, he never got a chance to prove his case. His investigation was terminated by his sudden death in 1936 under suspicious circumstances. The month he died, the journal Pelley's Weekly reported, open quote, "Now that this sterling American patriot has made the passing, it can be revealed that not long after his public utterance against the encroaching powers of the international bankers, it became known among his intimates that he had suffered two attacks against his life. The first attack came in the form of two revolver shots fired at him from ambush as he was alighting from a cab in front of one of the Capitol hotels. Fortunately, both shots missed him, the bullets burying themselves in the structure of the cab. He became violently ill after partaking of food at a political banquet at Washington. His life was only saved from what was subsequently announced as poisoning by the presence of a physician friend at the banquet, who at once procured a stomach pump and subjected the congressman to emergency treatment." Close quote. McFadden then died mysteriously of heart failure sudden death following a bout of intestinal flu. His petition for articles of impeachment against the Federal Reserve Board for fraud, conspiracy, unlawful conversion, and treason was never acted upon, but Wright Patman took up the torch where McFadden left off. So now let's look at how Wright Patman exposes the money machine. Going back to the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, The Discovery of Oz the Terrible, it says, open quote, "Toto jumped and tipped over the screen that stood in a corner. As it fell with a crash, they looked that way, and the next moment, all of them were filled with wonder. For they saw, standing in just the spot the screen had hidden, a little old man with a bald head and a wrinkled face who seemed to be as much surprised as they were. 'I am Oz, the great and terrible,' said the little man in a trembling voice." If Wright Patman had been a character in The Wizard of Oz, he would probably have been Dorothy's feisty dog Toto, who nipped fearlessly at the Wicked Witch's heels, saved his mistress by leaping boldly across a closing drawbridge, and exposed the man behind the curtain pretending to be a great and powerful wizard. Patman spent nearly 50 years barking at the wicked institutions he thought were out to get the farmers and small businessmen of his Texas constituency. They included big business, chain stores, tax-exempt foundations, and, most wicked of all, the Federal Reserve Board, whose restrictive monetary policies he felt placed the interests of Wall Street above those of Main Street. Patman was first elected to Congress in 1928 and was re-elected 24 times. He served as chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee from 1963 to 1975, and in Congress until his death in 1976. He was called an economic populist. He inspired a major protest march on Washington in 1932, the March of unemployed World War I veterans petitioning for the bonus bill, he wrote. Patman was the first to call for the investigation not only of Penn Central, 1970, but of Watergate, 1972. One reviewer described him as, open quote, a cranky eccentric, out of place in the increasingly slick and polished world of Washington politics. But therein lay his significance. He used his outsider status to force onto the national agenda issues that few politicians cared or dared to raise. Close quote. In his role as chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, Patman penetrated the official Fed speak to expose what was really going on. After a probing investigation of the Federal Reserve, he charged, open quote, the Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve System has the power to obtain and does obtain the printed money of the United States Federal Reserve notes from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing and exchanges these printed notes, which of course are not interest-bearing, for United States government obligations that are interest-bearing. After making the exchange, the interest-bearing obligations are retained by the 12 Federal Reserve banks, and the interest collected annually on these government obligations goes into the funds of the 12 Federal Reserve banks. These funds are expended by the system without an adequate accounting to Congress. Close quote. The Open Market Committee was the group formed in 1934 to take charge of open market operations, the Fed's buying and selling of government securities, bills, bonds, and notes by which the government borrows money. Then as now, the Open Market Committee acquired Federal Reserve notes from the Federal Bureau of Engraving and Printing, essentially for the cost of printing them. The average cost today is about 4 cents per bill. In deft card shark fashion, these dollar bills are then swapped for an equivalent stack of notes labeled Treasury Securities. Turning Treasury Securities, or debt, into money, Federal Reserve notes, is called monetizing the debt. The government owes this money back to the Fed, although the Fed has advanced nothing but printed paper to earn it. In a revealing treatise called A Primer on Money, Patman concluded, open quote, the Federal Reserve is a total money-making machine. It can issue money or checks, and it never has a problem of making its checks good because it can obtain the $5 bills and the $10 bills necessary to cover its checks simply by asking the Treasury Department's Bureau of Engraving to print them. End quote. This statement was confirmed by Mariner Eccles, then chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, in testimony before the House Banking and Currency Committee in 1935. Eccles acknowledged, open quote, in purchasing offerings of government bonds, the banking system as a whole creates new money or bank deposits. When the banks buy $1 billion of government bonds as they are offered, the banks credit the deposit account of the Treasury with $1 billion. They debit their government bond account $1 billion, or they actually create, by a bookkeeping entry, $1 billion. Close quote. Economist John Kenneth Galbraith would later comment, quote, the process by which banks create money is so simple that the mind is repelled. End quote. The mind is repelled because the process is sleight of hand and is completely foreign to what we have been taught. In a phenomenon called cognitive dissonance, we can read the words and still doubt whether we have read them right. And we will continue in this journey next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I am speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.